Good morning, all you kitchen mavens looking to cook like a pro.
Okay, no, we're not world travelers today. Huh?
No, we're in the kitchen
again today.
We're in the kitchen, but we have a lineup of really serious professional chefs.
Yeah, so this program's about how to cook like a professional.
Right. Now, let's mention that it's on the menu radio
right.
With Ann and Peter Hay.
There you go. We almost forgot that, didn't we?
Right. Well, I didn't really.
But
the first person up is, you can't even sum up all his experience, all his abilities, all of his concerns for teaching and his talents. Let's just listen to the...
Yeah, if there ever was a definition of a culinary professional, it is...
Jacques Pepin. Well, we're talking about a book called Essential Pepin by the essential chef Jacques Pepin, subtitled More Than 700 All-Time Favorites from My Life in Food. Jacques, this is certainly an incredible achievement.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. We did the 26th show for PBS out of the book. And they started about a couple of weeks ago, a little bit all over the country. So that's exciting, too, plus the DVD that I have in the book.
Yeah, tell us about the DVD. It adds this whole other dimension.
Yes, well, I wanted to show all of the technique, you know, that a young chef or a cook needs, and from sharpening a knife to boning out a chicken or making an omelette or whipping an egg or... You know, those basic technique and peeling an asparagus, so when you go through the book, you can refer to those techniques. Actually, you know, you can use those techniques for any book that you have, not necessarily that book. So I think that for young people, this is good because it's very, of course, visual, and it's 3 hours of technique, so it's quite a lot.
Now, for those people who've been living on another planet for the last 6 decades... Let's make sure that people understand that Jacques Pepin has been cooking now for about 6 decades.
Yes, well, I left home in 1949 to go into apprenticeship, so that's a long time. And I left home, actually, I was 13 years old, but when I left home, home was actually a restaurant where my mother was the chef and the owner. So even farther than that, as far as my memory can go, from age, 7, 8 to... I was always in some kitchen or another.
And you were born in Brest, the place that's so famous.
I was born, next to Lyon in France.
And that's the place that has the famous chickens.
Yes, the famous chickens. That's right.
Are they really that good?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, this is a leading question. Of course they are good. Chicken of Brest, they are free-range, a type of chicken, free-range. Actually, it's an interesting question because for a lot of young people who never had it, they're going to say, well, this is not that tender and all that. It's not as tender as the chicken you buy in a supermarket. It's more attached to the bone. It has much more flavor. It's different. But, I mean, we have very good chicken in this country as well. When if you get to free-range chicken, there is certain type which are really very good.
But it wasn't always thus. We've had a conversation before about what changed, and you said that when you first came to this country, you couldn't even find button mushrooms. If you wanted mushrooms, they had to come out of a can.
That's true. You're right. And there was only one salad in the supermarket. That was iceberg, you know. But now everyone is a locavore. You know? I mean, you have to support your local market. You get to... So say that my mother and my father were organic farmers. Of course, they didn't know the word organic did not exist, but since chemical fertilizer did not exist, and fungicide, insecticide, pesticide, all that stuff did not exist, so everyone was an organic farmer. You know?
Yes, well, so
we're going back to that. It's not...
Now, in the introduction to the book, you talk about the fact that the recipes in the book... were accumulated over an entire career spanning decades or so. So you had a dilemma as to what to do about that. Would you present the recipes the way they were first developed, or would you change them? Talk to our listeners a little bit about that process.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. We started with over 2,000 recipes and to scale it down. And as I said, I think in the introduction, the appetite of a young man, you know, my first book, I was in my 30s and a middle-aged man and now an old man are kind of different. So along the way, and the way we cook 30 years ago and so forth is different. So like the New York Times last year came out with the favorite of the New York Times, like 500-600 picture recipe or more.
Yeah, Amanda Hesser.
They left them the way they were to show a moment in time. And I suppose I could have done that, but I wanted them to be useful and more in tune to what we do now. So I had to start changing them. And that includes a great deal of work, almost more than doing a book from scratch. The amount of fat that we use are different. We don't use as much butter. We use much more olive oil. We use less fat. The amount of cooking in vegetable, in fish particularly, has changed. The combination of ingredients has changed as well. The way you get food in a supermarket has changed to the way it used to be. So all of that has to be taken into account. And my idea was always to simplify cooking as much as I could. That's probably my Cartesian side, you know. So I still, even recipes which were not that old, redoing them, I simplify them even to make them more easier for the home cook.
So then this is a recipe. This is not just Jacques Pepin cooking for his audience. This is designed for people who are running with reasonably sophisticated but still home cooking skills to be able to work, right?
Yes, I feel that, interesting people told me, what do you think your book? And I said, this is really what American cuisine is for me. Because even though I'm French, the black bean soup with banana that I have in the book, because I'm married to a woman born in New York from a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father, from this to a ceviche, to a fried chicken, to an apple crumble or stuff like that. Those are not French recipes. They are recipes that I gather in the last 40 years, and I don't really try to be French. And by the same token, I don't try not to be French. I don't really think in those terms. I do the dishes that I like. I simplify them, and that's it. You know, I mean, we do some Chinese cooking at home. We do Mexican cooking. We do a little bit of everything, you know.
Well, now, you've had an illustrious TV career as well. Are you still working with your daughter?
Yes, actually, you know, this is the 12th series of 26 shows that I do at KQED, the PBS station in San Francisco, so that's 25 years, really,
uh-huh.
or more. And Claudine, in the last series out of that book, came and did a few shows with me, and I also did a few shows with my granddaughter, Shori. I have a granddaughter which is 7 years old, so.
And she was on too, huh?
And she was on too, doing chocolate with me, you know.
One of the things that's interesting about this, of course, is how you've over the years interacted with your environment. We've talked about all the changes you've seen in 60 years,
uh-huh.
but you've always interacted with your environment. You've always stayed modern. And the sheer volume of these recipes, did you have to test all of these again?
Well, not all of them, but most of them. I mean, a fair amount. I mean, the one that I changed, certainly, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe I work a bit differently for the better or for the worse. You know, there is a lot of chefs, certainly, which have a team, sometimes a test kitchen.
Oh, sure.
And you have a whole group of a chef in a restaurant sometimes working toward one book. In my life, I work with Norma, with my assistant, for the last 27 years, and I am alone. I go to the market, I have an idea, I do a recipe, I write it on a yellow pad. Norma type it the day after, then I do an introduction and look at it and type it, and basically that's it. So there is, it's really just my point of view. It's different than working from a restaurant floor and from a whole kitchen, you know.
Well, I think, first of all, that it's remarkable that each one of these chapters, and the chapters are rather straightforward.
Uh-huh.
You have shellfish and fish, and you have soup, and you have appetizers and so forth. But each one of these chapters could be a whole book.
Well, yeah, thank you. And as I said, you know, we pare it down from 2,000 to about 700 recipes. Starting with, you know, when I start looking at the book, let's say I would look at salmon and I may have 25 recipes for salmon, but 5 or 6 or 7 are pretty much the same ingredient, too many similarities, so I would cut it down, just keeping 1 or 2 or whatever. So that's how we started cutting it down. And then after I argue with my editor, she wanted to keep some, I wanted to keep others, and so forth.
Right. Now, the other thing that's notable, I mean, because I've written a cookbook with the chef, and I must say that his recipes went on and on and on. Your recipes are very direct, very concise, and very lucid to follow.
Thank you. Thank you. I think that's what I have been a chef for all my life, but certainly in the last 35 years here, I have been teaching, whether
yes.
it's on television or in my book or in newspaper article. So I consider myself probably a teacher more than anything else. And for me, the act of teaching is always simplifying, again, making it more achievable and so forth. You see, it's a different point of view. Again, if I had a great restaurant, like Per Se, you know, if I were Thomas Keller, if I go to do a demonstration, I would do a demonstration to show you the quality of what I do in my restaurant, which is extraordinary, to show you the uniqueness of what I do. And whether you can do it at home or not is kind of immaterial at that point. This is not my case. I don't have a restaurant. I teach cooking, so when I do ingredient also, I use the supermarket, the best that I can find in a supermarket, but still the supermarket, because otherwise people say, where am I going to find that stuff, you know?
Uh-huh.
So, again, so my goal is really teaching and simplifying recipe.
Well, this is very clear. When did this talent for drawing manifest itself? I mean, they are just charming drawings.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I have been painting and drawing for probably, I don't know, over 40, 50 years. I have had some art show, actually. So here, you know, first it was going to be in color, and they said, no, you can only do it in black and white. And I wanted to illustrate the book so that it wasn't, since, as I say, we did not have any color of the food, any color picture of the food in that book, since I had the DVD. So I decided to do those drawings to give some variant. And
yeah, but they're delightful. They're right on, too. You're not trained in drawing, are you?
Thank you. No, I think one time I took a class at Columbia University when I was there as a young student, and I had a time, so I took a class in drawing, but that's many, many years ago. I don't even remember what we did, but
well, I'm looking at three potatoes, just simple three potatoes with two eyes each, and they're beautiful.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm proud that you like my potato.
Oh, I love it. I mean, this is one of many. You've a way with chickens, too.
Right.
Well, he had time to doodle these off while his chicken was cooking.
Yeah, right.
Look at this duck. The duck has so much personality, Jacques.
Right, okay.
Hear the duck saying, "Now you want me to do what? You want me to climb in this pan? I don't think so."
Now, you obviously over the years have built up favorite groups of ingredients to work with.
Yes.
It's unfair to ask, but I'm going to ask anyhow. Give us a clue as to the kinds of things you gravitate towards.
Well, you know, again, unless I have a special dinner to do or a class to give, and I am committed to do that recipe and that one. If this is not the case, which is not the case usually, when I go to the market, the menu is decided usually by what's at the market.
Right.
You know, I go with, I think I'll do a cauliflower tonight, and I see beautiful artichokes, and sometimes less beautiful artichokes, but they are for half price because they're already yellowish, and I'm going to do artichoke bottom with them. And that's how usually I decide on the menu for the night, you know, depending on. And, of course, in the summer, there is a fair amount of farm market here, you know, local market. So I love to go to those markets and buy stuff.
So you decide that day.
Yes,
based on what's there. So people using this book probably would be very sensible to go about selecting their menu in just the same way, I guess.
Yes, of course.
Now, they better be careful because they better carry the index with them in their heads because there's only one disappointment. There's only one dish I can't find that's in there.
Oh, yeah, right.
Which is tongue.
Uh-huh.
So you don't have a tongue recipe. It's, I feel almost like let down.
Well, you know, on the other hand, there is always another choice. There is 700 recipes there. If you don't have those ingredients, you do something else. Or you start substitute. For me, when you use a book, I would say that the first time you use that, whether it's my book or any other book, you should really probably follow the recipe exactly for the sake of whoever wrote the recipe. And by the second time you do it, then you're likely to take a faster look at it and say, how long was that in the oven, to whatever. By the third time you do it, if it turned out good, then you're likely to do it again. And by the third time, you're going to do it faster. And by the fourth time, you don't even look at the book. You, quote, improve the recipe. At that point, you say, I think I'll put a bit more tomato in there. I won't put any of this. And then a year later, you don't even remember where the recipe comes from. It becomes your recipe, and you have adapted to your own taste. That's the way it should be.
Right. I remember once I was going to make is it adobe or adobe? I always pronounce
adobe,
it.
Yes,
I always
right.
pronounce it wrong. And I got two conflicting recipes. One of them was Amanda Hesser's recipe from the New York Times cookbook.
Uh-huh.
And she insisted that it's important to brown the meat.
Oh.
And then there was Anne Willen's recipe from Country French Cooking.
Uh-huh.
And she said, no, you put the meat in the bottom, and then you put all these vegetables and olives, and you put everything in layers on top.
Uh-huh.
And then you put in a whole bottle of red wine, and you let it sit for a day or two.
Right.
So I thought, well, that sounds like a little less trouble, so that's the one I made.
Right.
Now, where do you come down? You have a dobe in there, too.
Yes.
But yours, yours isn't quite the same.
Yes. It can be done one way or the other without any question, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be made marinating or not marinated. It can be made sometime you bring the wine, even sometime you put vinegar and wine mixed together, and sometime you heat it up and you put it hot on top of the meat, and so like that you marinate it in a couple of hours what it would have been to leave it overnight if you started with cold ingredient, you know.
Yeah.
So there is different way of doing it.
The only thing I'm worried about is with this much wisdom, with this many recipes, I can imagine going out and supermarketing or farmers marketing to get the ingredients, and then I'd start reading the book and it would be 8 o'clock and I wouldn't have started cooking dinner yet because I couldn't decide which one of these delicious recipes to make.
Well, you have to have a glass of wine, it helps.
Well, of course.
Now, you also have tips in here, cleaning squid, for example, other kinds of just practical tips.
Right.
One of them I'd never heard before is that you actually, everybody I've read always says that you bring the eggs to room temperature before whipping them.
Right.
And you said you like them cold.
Right. Now, I'll tell you something. I buy my eggs now on the road here. A little lady who has a dozen chicken, and at that point, the chicken are really, I mean, the eggs are of very good quality because the chicken eat grass and worm and stuff like this. So that type of eggs, which are that type of quality, if I beat them at room temperature, I get more volume. But when I get ordinary eggs from the supermarket, which are really not very good, if I let them come to room temperature and I start beating them, the egg whites start breaking down, getting whippy before it's halfway beaten, because the albumin, you know, in the egg white is not very good. It's not very good quality. So at that point, I'd rather beat it cold. I get a bit less volume, but I get a tighter texture with better bubble, you know.
Oh, boy. Well, what else is to say? I mean, you obviously know what you're doing, and this book helps us all along the route to making better food. I think you should be very proud of having accomplished this.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm glad.
And I treasure it.
In the cooking world, this is what being a cook with. It's gratifying. You know, you cook, you always cook for the other. And someone, to see the face of someone lighting up, whether it's your child or your grandchild or your cousin or your mother or your lover, this is the gratification that you get, you know, of doing what we do. And this is the reason to go into that business. And I say that to a lot of young chefs, because a lot of chefs want to go on television and write a book
right away. Right.
And I say it's likely that it may never happen to you. It may happen, but it may not. And if you go into that business just for that reason, you're likely to have serious disappointment, you know. But if you go because you feel gratified by it and you love what you're doing, then you will always be happy. And you may happen to become famous, too.
You said here, and there's your quote, there is no greater love than the love of cooking.
Right.
One always cooks for another. That's
it's
beautiful,
true.
Jacques. And so are you, and so is your book.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Uh-huh.
Have a great holiday.
You too.
Bye. Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with you after a short break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, the Culinary Institute of America, the big training ground for professional chefs, regularly updates and always expands its instructional cookbook called The Professional Chef.
And they did it again.
And they did it again. And we're going to talk to Brad Barnes about it and also introduce, this is the first year that there's actually an iPad application for the Professional Chef cookbook. So let's listen to what he has to say. Brad Barnes. Well, we got a lot of exercise hoisting this book around. It's the 9th edition of The Professional Chef, produced by the Culinary Institute of America. And I have an early edition, which is a lot smaller. We're going to talk to Brad Barnes of the Culinary Institute, which we will refer to as the CIA, with the warning it's not the CIA that a lot of people think of. And Brad, you were the spokesperson for this edition. Why is it so much heavier?
Well, the book itself incorporated a little bit of a new style and kind of a, ironically so, lighter appearance throughout the photography and the formatting of the pages. And in that is taken in some more pages. We have increased the amount of photography of things like produce and dishes and recipe results, or the end results of the piece, so the dish itself or the product. So a lot more photography certainly causes a bunch more pages, ultimately, because they're nice big photographs. And of course, this ties into, while it caused us a little more paper on the book here, and certainly a lot more ink, it also prepared the book to be converted digitally.
And that's coming very soon, I understand.
That's coming up very soon. We have a press release announcement for it in San Francisco next week, and I'll be there for that, and it should be great. We have a lot of good folks coming.
Be sure to go eat at Qua.
I was just looking at that.
Fabulous.
I think I'm going to.
Yeah.
And the other place you've got to go to is two places in one, really, so you have to go twice, Cotonia and Quince.
Really? I don't have those.
Both extraordinary restaurants.
Oh, I think somebody did tell me Quince. So, that's great.
Well, Cotonia is sort of like a baby brother, which is a more casual option.
Great.
A great place to go at lunchtime. They have some kind of magnificent green-painted Italian wood-fired, what do you call it, a grill?
It was a grill and an oven, too, I think.
Yeah. Anyways, it's the centerpiece of what...
Wood-fired or something.
Yeah, it's wood-fired, but it's. I guess it must be made out of cast iron or something like that. And it's
beautiful.
I think it might be only one of only like two or three in the country. The chef, Michael Tusk, imported it from Italy because he had heard about it and decided he would want to build a menu around it.
Right.
And then there's Chris Cosentino.
Well, there are so many places
to go.
There's so
many places. How long are you there for?
For a day and a half.
Okay. Well, forget that.
Well, in that case, you'll have to eat several meals a day.
Hey, you know what? I'm used to that.
Yeah.
I'm sure you are, yes.
Yeah.
Because, listeners, we shouldn't forget that in addition to taking time out to help produce this book, you are an active member of the faculty.
Well, I am actually... I'm the senior director of culinary education, so...
So that's a big job.
That's almost like the big boss, right?
Almost.
Now, who exactly is this for?
Well, that's, I think, should transform that question into who can make use of this book. And that runs the gamut because it is all about fundamentals and basics and certainly goes through so many important subjects to being a good cook and as well being able to transform that into being a professional cook. So what we've done, and I think quite successfully, is we've put the information in a format that a young person with their sights on being a professional cook or, of course, growing into a chef, or someone that is just a serious foodie or even trying to learn to be a serious foodie and wants to appreciate food in a different way or understand more about how they could approach food, this is great for them. You know, we have a philosophy here that it's not so much the recipe but the method. And we certainly teach serious skills of how to, not necessarily the recipe. So we don't teach by recipe, we teach by method. And And the book very much sticks to that. So if you want to know how to do something and make it delicious, that really happens off of correct methodology and proper technique and thinking about the right things and choosing the right groceries and making the right flavor combination assessments and the planning. And you don't have to be, while that can sound a little off-putting maybe, it's relatively simplistic because at the end of the day, the best food, the most delicious food, tastes exactly like what it is, and that comes from a good, solid methodology. So,
well, you know, as a food writer and broadcaster, I have for years now used this as a reference book.
And it's a great reference book. And,
exactly.
You know, folks, if folks want to know, geez, what should be in on a piece of meat before you cook it, or how do I actually take that piece of meat off of the chicken or the lamb leg or the piece of pork that I bought? How do I cut a pork cutlet? And then how do I grill it?
Yeah, it's an absolutely marvelous book. I was leafing through the section on the different cuts of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that possessing this book, you could probably drive a butcher insane. by saying, you know, I want this piece that they write about in this book. A lot of butchers might not even have heard of it.
You might end up delighting the butcher that someone actually asked for something that they learned how to cut a long time ago. So.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything that's not in this book, to be honest. Maybe we should put it that way.
did you actually deliberately leave anything out?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I'm not going to say it's mistake-free, though. So.
Right, but
you certainly didn't leave anything out.
No. We try to put everything up front so everybody can be a better cook because, you know, with that just comes folks more engaged in food and cooking, and that's where we want the world to be.
Now, when we say that you've kept up with the times and you've modernized everything, you have some really interesting new issues addressed in this book, such as sustainability, biodiversity, and also techniques, sous vide. So it's a very modern thing, but I guess these are things that everybody needs to know now, or at least know where to go to find out about.
And to start to understand them. And, you know, some of those subjects are very deep and very wide and certainly couldn't be covered completely in a book like this, but we do start to address a lot of things that are important for certainly a young cook planning to be a professional. And there's more to come, too. So, you know, as we start to cover sous vide here, we kind of creep into what that's about.
Thomas Keller wrote a whole book on it.
Oh, yeah, and there's a lot of other things out there about that, and I can tell you on the horizon you'll see us developing a lot more to do with that particular methodology.
Even if a chef doesn't advertise that he's doing it, most of them do now.
Yeah,
right?
we have one restaurant in Pittsburgh, and that's Salt of the Earth, and that, essentially that's his cooking method.
Right.
So he has 4 or 5 sous vide ovens, and that's the backbone of his whole approach to preparing
food.
What
they do, right.
Now tell us the digital component. Do you have sort of demo videos of processes and things?
I can't give away a lot because we have a lot of folk counting on the upcoming press party. But there, as with the way technology works these days, there's a lot of interactive pieces. And I think, to me, one of the most important things that it does or allows a user to do is to really use it in the way that you would love to use any book. You're reading through the pages and you say, well, geez, I wonder what that means. More than likely, you're going to be able to find out pretty quickly and probably very deeply what that means. So there's ways to keep notes in it, and there's ways to stick pages so that they are there when you want them to come back so you don't have to fold the corners. And to all extent and purposes, the iPad version has done away with bookmarks as pieces of paper. But it's going to be real easy for somebody to plan and go back to their plan in order to go through a particular dish and accomplish a meal, per se. So there's some really cool stuff about the way this works.
Sounds cool, yeah.
I think the most important thing is it really does. It works very well for the home cook as well. So.
Now, I have a really weird question.
I can't imagine you having a really weird question.
I mean, based on the fact that I have just received the updated, is it Good Housekeeping, the red and white checkbook?
Oh, that was Betty. No, that's Betty Crocker.
Betty Crocker.
I had the updated one of that. And they don't take anything away. They just add things. Now, have you taken whole sections out that you used to do in the 1960s, say, of this book?
Yeah.
Are there things that are dead in culinary education now?
As far as table of contents, I don't think it's fair to say that. Exact items, yes, there has been items that have removed over the years. I don't know exactly from the last version to this version. I don't think there's a lot of that. But going back to the earlier books, the 1, 2s, 3s, that sort of thing, there's definitely some things that are not here anymore.
What are some of them? I'm just curious.
See, how about stuffed tomato clamel? We don't have that. That's little peas and cream and mushrooms stuffed in a tomato half. So I think that's gone.
Yeah, we had to make that when I was in college.
Well, and at one time, a critical garnish component for a lot of very upscale dishes. Just made me think, and I actually was flipping through here. I wanted to see if Waldorf salad is still in.
Oh, right. That's making a comeback, you know.
Well, it's I don't know. It is in here. Okay. I don't know that it's ever disappeared. But it certainly has resurfaced and reinvented itself several times over. But in general, you look in here, and whereas in the 60s we may have had a pickled celery root julienne salad, we have celeriac and tart apple salad. So
Okay. Maybe
the words are different. We probably had pickled beets in the early versions, and now we have roasted beets and baby greens with rhodiola and walnuts. So they certainly, I don't think we've lost anything. There's a Cobb salad in here.
Baked Alaska?
Baked Alaska? I don't know if it's in this book. I'm sure it's in the pastry book.
Oh, so this is not the only book you need. So there's
no.
This
is all savory.
There is some pastry.
There's some dessert.
There's some pastry in here.
Yep.
But there's a companion book.
There is. There's baking and pastry.
Wow.
So, which is Mastering the Art and Craft. And that's a great book. That is, to all equivalencies, the model of this book on the sweet side.
I think that's passed through our hands. I'm pretty sure it has.
It has.
It's a great book.
Wonderful achievement. How long before the next one? How long does it take to do this repetition stuff?
As soon as this hit my desk, I began to work on the revised edition. So, and actually even before this hit my desk, because it takes, obviously, you know, we perceive that the cooking profession is at a kind of a turn in the road, if you will, and I think there's going to be even more differences from number 9 to the grand 10th version. So
that would be a 10th anniversary edition.
In closing, why do you say that? You said the culinary profession is at a crossroads or
turning point
because we are at a place where, for the first time in my life, and I've been cooking since about 1974 professionally, for the first time in my life we are seeing founded, documented new methodology for preparing food with some very new and different results of the process. And that means that we're adding tools to our belt, and we're adding tools that we've never seen before and we've never thought about before.
You mean like induction?
Well, induction is certainly kind of part of that, but more so the modernist cuisine types of approaches and some of the things that have grown out of manufacturing and science. And we're also seeing a real change in the way that our students learn and hold information. And it's good because it has to do with a higher level of precision in cooking. And many of the best restaurants out there these days don't just sprinkle salt anymore. They measure it and they use it. And that, I assure you, never occurred in my career when I was working on a hotline.
Okay, so this is where the 10th edition is going to go, and you're keeping up, right?
We're going to be ahead by the time that one comes out.
So you're trendsetters.
Yes, sir.
You're not trend reporters, you're trendsetters.
We are.
That's the way it should be.
What do you think of this modernist cuisine book?
I think it's very,
books.
Very interesting.
Books.
And
plural.
Well, yeah, those books. There's a lot of great information in there, and to me, it's kind of like any change in a period of art
Right.
Surrealism moves into expressionism, or we grow into modern art and we grow out of modern art. We're in that kind of a transition in the culinary world, I believe, and certainly modernist cuisine played a part in that. So
wow.
It's great stuff.
I have yet to see that book. I mean, the books, the volumes.
Ours doesn't weigh anything compared to that.
No, I know. I mean, there's, what, 6 books? I can't remember.
Oh, that's the guy from Microsoft.
Yes,
Nathan Mierhold.
Yeah. That's right.
I think I'm going to find out if Bill Fuller actually bought one for the Big Burrito restaurant group, and they'll go see it.
This is a chef friend of ours. He'd probably charge you for a visit.
Yeah, he should.
For what it costs. It's been great, Brad. Great fun talking to you about this. And, you know, I'm, I've I told you before, I always feel connected to the CIA anyhow. So many friends there and friends going through there. So, and you do a great job.
Well, I appreciate that, and we really appreciate you taking the time to include us and think of us. You know, we love what we do, and this is a really important milestone, so.
How does one get a copy? Just finish it off with that.
Well, that can certainly be found on Wiley.com and also on the Culinary Professional Chef website.
Okay, and digital?
You can also get the link through On the Menu Radio's bookshelf.
That's right.
There you go.
We have it on our bookshelf. That's good. All right. Wait to see what develops with your digital debut.
It's going to be very cool.
Okay. Thanks again, Brad.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, everybody knows and loves Molly Stevens, and you're going to be in good hands if you follow all her instructions about roasting. The book is called All About Roasting, A New Approach to a Classic Art. And it's another one of those masterpieces that she turns out. Molly Stevens is a classically trained chef, and didn't you also do a stint as an English major?
Oh, yes, I did. Twice.
Well, having been an art history major myself, I picked up on that one right away. Your research. You really came to attention for, in addition to all of your teaching. I don't know how you have time to do all this teaching and all this demonstrating and traveling back and forth across the country. You had your first book, or at least it's not your first book, it's the one that really put you in the limelight, was all about braising. And if you've done a repeat here, I think it's a wonderful book, especially in its clarity and its completion. It's so beautiful. It is all about roasting, which is making a huge comeback, as you mentioned.
Well, yeah, thank you. And roasting is something we've always done, but it's getting new attention, which is great.
Well, you actually put it into perspective. I used to just panic every time I had to do the turkey or the prime rib or whatever it was, because I wasn't sure how I'd ever know about timing. And you put the whole thing in perspective and saying that there are really many different approaches to roasting, and you give different suggestions to these approaches.
Yeah, I think it was James Beard who said it. He said there are many ways to attack a roast beef, was his choice of words.
Right.
There are ways to roast fast and hot and slow and low, and they all have, you know, different reasons for choosing them. And what I often say is that roasting is easy. It's the knowing when to stop that's hard.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that was brilliant.
Now, you do have some interesting quotes at the beginning, the suggestion from Brillat Savarin that roasters were born, not made, and then someone with a contradictory point of view.
Yeah, and of course, when you're thinking about when Brillat Savarin was speaking, this is when they're still doing, some of the roasting is still happening in its original format, which is in front of a live fire. And where it comes from cooking on a rotisserie in front of real flame. And so that's a little bit more challenging than what we do today when we set our oven to 375 or something.
You're big on, first of all, absolutely, as everybody knows, you have to start with very good, with the appropriate cut of whatever you're using, meat or poultry, or you do vegetables and fruit and so forth, but also the quality.
Yeah, and because roasting is such a simple, I think of it as a simple, direct, even honest way of cooking, it's hard to mask something. It concentrates the intrinsic flavors of whatever it is you're cooking. So if you start with a really good chicken, or I have some roasted seafood in the book, whatever it is, it's only going to get better. If you start with something mediocre,
probably going to get worse.
Yeah, it might be. So it really does call to attention the quality of the ingredients you're starting with.
Now, let me be a little controversial here. I mean, it seems like such a simple thing to do.
Roasting.
And yet, clearly, with a book this size, with such an enormous amount of useful information in it. It's not as simple as it looks.
Well, Peter, it is simple. It's you turn on an oven and whatever you're going to cook it in, and you put the food in it. Having said that, there are lots of nuances. There's a lot. As a cooking teacher, you mentioned earlier, Ann, I like to know why things are happening. So I spend quite a bit of time talking about things like heat transfer, which you don't need. Do you need to know that to roast a chicken? No, but if you'd like to know it, it's there for
it's
you
here.
In the book. Yeah. So many of the recipes are simple. I was just talking today. There's a basic roasted rack of lamb. Salt and pepper, heat your oven, slide the rack of lamb in, pretty much does itself. Having said that, then what if you want to dress it up? What if you want to add a sauce or a spice rub? So it is simple yet, but not limited to just being simple.
And you have all that in here, all these, what did you call them?
Options.
No, you called them add-ons or something.
Add-ons,
or
oh yes, with, all the add-ons, with. Yep.
Goes with. But start at the beginning where one of the most crucial things is decide between high heat or low heat.
Sure. High heat is so many advantages because the food will brown, and when we think of roasting, we want things that have browned edges and crispy end bits and sizzling exterior, and a high heat will give you that. Problem with the high heat is it will, I liken it, and I say this in the book, so, you know, if you're driving in a car very, very fast, and you try to stop, well, it takes a little bit to stop. If you're going slowly, it's easier to stop. And this is the same with roasting. If you're roasting at high heat and you're trying to get that beef rib roast to a perfect pink inside and not beyond, it's easy to miss that little window.
Right.
And with some things high heat, I use it with the smaller the roast, the better you can control when you pull it out and it's carryover cooking, so high heat works very well. Pork doesn't respond well, at least I find pork doesn't respond well to high. So in general, it has to do with the nature of the pork, the texture of it. It tends to dry out very easily. So I prefer to do pork at a low heat.
And you talk about crackling, which is, in our house, this was a big issue because coming from the UK, Peter liked his crackling on his pork roast. And unfortunately, the USDA doesn't like it in the States.
No, and you know, but I think we're starting to see a few producers are selling pork. Well, and you're talking about a pork loin with crackling on it.
Oh, yeah.
And until recently, you would never see that over here. But, Peter, I couldn't agree more. A good British skin-on pork loin.
When we visited with my brother who lived in a small town in Cornwall, there was a local butcher shop who butchered local pigs. And you could get a loin roast with the crackling on the outside and the kidneys on the inside.
Yeah, there you go.
And when Uncle Peter came, the little kiddywinkies, my little nephews really loved it because they got as much meat as they wanted. Whereas my brother would always buy too little. Mm-hmm. I guess if it's possible to buy too much, I would do that. But there was certainly always plenty.
So now, I had a question about my yard. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
I get confused. Didn't Harold McGee say that it was wrong that you don't brown, sear, and knock in juices?
Correct.
So where do you stand on that?
So, yes, when you sear something, get a nice brown surface on it, and there's every reason to do that, whether you're braising, roasting, stewing, whatever you're doing. But our books used to tell us, and our chefs and cooks used to tell us, that searing was also sealing or locking in the juice.
And that's not true.
And that's not true. If you think you take a lovely steak and you pan sear it in a nice cast iron pan and then put that steak on a plate or on a cutting board, well, within a few minutes you're going to have a little puddle of juice coming out from the inside. So that's just proof that we're not locking them in. Having said that, this is, you know, let's throw out the baby with the bathwater. It's still an excellent technique for developing flavor, making our food more attractive, and so we do still sear for color and flavor.
So there really is something that happens.
This
Maillard effect is real.
It is very real. It's just not a... And the Maillard, the reason I talk about it in the book is because if a food science person were to look at the use of caramelization, the term, that really... We use that very loosely, and it just means the browning, but when you get to meat and proteins, it's not technically caramelization.
No, that's sugar.
But I say conversation because we all know what we mean.
Now, one other question before we launch into all the other things the book offers. Where do you come down on the difference between salting and wet, I guess it's dry salting and wet salting or brining?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have more and more I dry salt or dry brine, however you want to call it, but dry salt. And by this I mean seasoning the protein, meat, poultry, for a day or two before I cook it.
And you use a lot of it. I can't remember the amount per pound of meat, but it seemed to me like a lot of salt.
It's about a quarter teaspoon per pound.
Oh, that's not too bad.
Which is not too bad. It looks like a lot when you first salt it, but in the end, the meat will not have a salty flavor. It will simply taste savory. It will taste seasoned. And the reason I only do a little bit of the wet brining, and I do still do that in the pork chapter a few times. What I like about the dry brine, it goes back to what we were talking about using good quality ingredients. When you add a wet brine, you're actually diluting the flavor in a way, but
yeah,
you're adding
that.
Water.
I never thought of it until you said it.
Yeah, because it does absorb water. In fact, it's highly recommended for pork for that reason, right? Because
exactly.
Because you want to get some more liquid into the meat if you can.
Right, and make it juicier. And if you actually weigh a chicken before you brine it and then weigh it after you brine it, that chicken will actually have gained weight. It'll have taken on this water. But I'm a big proponent of the dry salt because then it's not moisture-added tap water, really. It's really good flavor, intense flavor of the chicken itself.
And you're a strong believer in thermometers.
I am for when you're learning your way around, and it also, it's that little extra confidence of how do you know if it's done. And I think we all know cooks who can just by a whiff and a poke can tell. They can sniff it and touch it and know exactly the doneness. But for the rest of us mortals who cook things not every day, every night, thermometers are a nice way to know where you're at.
And you advocate putting one in your oven, too.
Yes, every oven is a little bit, I think, a little bit off, or, a little hot, a little cool, and having an oven thermometer sitting on the rack will just reassure you that you're really, you know what temperature you're roasting at, and it's a very good idea.
Okay, and verdict on these racks, the roasting racks?
Roasting racks, I really thought, I changed my opinion a little bit. I used to think that I would insist on using them, and I don't so much, and especially when you're high heat roasting, because if you put food up on a rack and you heat it in a very hot oven, any dripping that comes off that piece of meat or poultry is going to hit that hot pan and evaporate immediately and even possibly start to scorch. So sometimes I like to roast things directly on the pan, and that gives you a little bit better tasting drippings.
And you also, you talk about the pans, the shape of the pans, the shape of the meat in terms of timing. You make a stab at Yorkshire pudding. Just because it comes from Yorkshire.
I know, now I'm embarrassed. How'd I do?
I don't know. You have to have his mother's pan to be able to make it.
I'm sure. Well, it's my father's recipe, so at least it has some history behind it. But
Peter says that my Yorkshire pudding resembles where we're living, like it was flat in Kansas City and it was hilly in Pittsburgh.
Right.
She never got it right.
I told
her to give up.
Yeah. It's funny. The Yorkshire pudding, I'm glad you mentioned it. It's one of the few recipes in the book that is not really a roast of some sort. But I can't do a prime rib without making Yorkshire pudding because all those beef drippings are so wonderfully luxurious, and if people don't have an excuse to use them, I'm just afraid they're going to get rid of them, and that breaks my heart.
Well, you understand, of course, the reason why thrifty Yorkshire families did that, right?
Well, sure. Stretch
the meal. Make sure there's enough left over for lunch on Monday.
yep. And I always put the Yorkshire pudding at the beginning of the buffet line before they get to the beef.
So that's true.
Fills up their plate, right?
Well, in my house, it was served as a separate course.
Yes. Yes.
So you got the Yorkshire pudding before, until my mother chickened out and started making Lancashire style in little bun tins and serving it on the plate with everything else.
Right.
Which my sister unfortunately does too.
Yeah, I was glad.
Traitors that they are.
Well, okay, here we are with, you tell us what to buy, how to measure, how to time, the techniques, the tools you need, and so forth. Then you take all your different categories, beef, lamb, goat went in there. What else you have? Pork,
yep, pork chapter. And then a poultry chapter that has chicken, turkey, goose, duck, quail, Cornish game hens.
Right. And you do vegetables and even fruits.
Mm-hmm.
And all the things that go along with them. Let's talk a little bit about how really delicious some of these recipes are.
Well, oh, and you forgot seafood. There's a little bit of a seafood chapter in there, too.
There is, too, right.
Yeah, it's one of those.
I mean, let's just sum this up, Satan. This is actually a very complete book, and it's all about roasting, and this is for true. But you also bring in some different kinds of flavorings. It's not all straight American-style roasting. You do a chimichurri, and you do all kinds of other Asian spice things, too?
Yeah, I do. And when I was putting together the book, I started with the basic recipes, but then palates have become so international, and our pantries are so global, and people have regularly just a range of flavors from ginger and soy to chili paste and limes, fish sauce, and things like that. And I like to be able to bring these things into everyday cooking because it just adds variety and, you know, limits boredom. And so the way they're generally done in these recipes is that it'll give you a basic recipe and then what we call options or go-withs. And so here's a roasted tri-tip steak, but here's the chimichurri that is really beautiful with it. So you could, if you just felt like just doing the tri-tip, great, or you have some other flavoring you want to do, but here's an idea to gussy it up again, I guess is the way to say it.
Yeah, I like your blasted broccoli. That looks really good.
Yes, yeah, and that's a great example. Blasted broccoli on its own, which is blasted for high heat, it's a short time in a hot oven, and that comes with, if you choose, a Kalamata olive vinaigrette.
Yeah, I like that one. I like that as
mm-hmm.
an option.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could say one of the recipes, this is always hard, and silly to ask, but if you could pick one recipe to kind of showcase so you could run us through it for our listeners, what would it be?
Well, and right now I'm really loving the butterfly roast chicken. I feel like if I could only roast chicken one way for the rest of my life, it would have to be the butterfly roast chicken. And because when you roast a whole chicken, you always have that problem of getting it cooked all the way evenly.
Right.
So this is a really simple recipe for basically flattening a chicken, taking out the backbone and making the chicken flat.
This is where the book comes in useful too, right? Because so, if you can't get it flat, you just hit it with the book a couple of times and it's done.
It weighs 4 pounds, Peter. It's going to flatten by then.
No, I used it already today. I'm using crushed coriander seeds on my tuna tonight.
Oh, you do it too? I was going to tell you, there's a tuna restaurant.
So I bashed it with All About Roasting.
So glad it's useful.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book. I could talk on about it, Molly, for ages and ages, but I think the best thing to do is to recommend it and have people go out. And this is a really important resource for a classic technique for preparing food and also for preparing holiday food, which we're coming up to as well.
Yeah, and all the holiday, the turkey's in there, the prime rib is in there, the roast goose, so hopefully those are recipes people can use.
Well, Molly, don't be such a stranger. 7 years ago, you were on the program talking about braising. Now you're roasting. I'm not sure what you're going to do next, but can you put the pedal to the metal and get us a new book a bit sooner?
I'm a slow study, Peter, but I eventually get there.
Well, it's been delightful reading your book and also talking to you, Molly. Do you have a helpline number so that when I get caught up in one of these, I don't know what to do next, I could call? We interviewed somebody who has that.
I'm surprised you don't. You could help a lot of people, I'm sure.
Any help. Well, thank you again, Molly.
Lovely to talk to you both. Thank you so much.
So there you are, all better prepared now to cook like a pro in the kitchen. And we expect to hear reports from people who are doing exactly that.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is really an amazing book that's all about roasting. It's something that we take for granted, but she puts a whole new perspective on it. Anyhow, I think we should move on. We have lots more books to cover in the coming weeks.
And we'll see you again, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.